Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th Canto, Chapter 12, Rahugana converses with Jatbara, Text 5 and 6. Brahmana uvacha ayam jano namachalam prithivyam yapartiva partiva kasya hetuh. Tasya pichangriyorani gulpa janga janura majura sirudanam sha Brahmana vacha. The Brahmana said, I am this janaha person. Nama, celebrated as such. Chalan, moving. Prithivyam, on the earth. Yaha, who? Partivaha, a transformation of the earth. Partiva, O king, who possesses a similar earthly body. Kasya, for what? Hetu, reason. Tasyapi, of him also. Cha, and. Angriyo, feet. Adi, above. Gulpa, ankles. Junga, calves. Janu, knees. Uru, thighs. Majura, waist. Shiradara, neck. Amsaha, shoulders. And then text number 6. Amsidi darvi sibika chayasyam. Sovira rajiti apadishaste yasmin bhavan rudani jabimano rajasmi sindhu siti durmadanda. Amse, shoulder. Adhi, upon. Darvi, made of wood. Shivika, palanquin. Cha, and. Yasyam, on which? Suvira Raja, the king of Suvira. Iti, thus. Apadeshaha, known as. Aste, there is. Yasmin, in which? Bhavan, your lordship. Ruda, imposed upon. Nijja avimanaha, having a conception of false prestige. Raja asmi, I am the king. Sindhusu, in the state of Sindhu. Iti, thus. Durmada andaha, captivated by false prestige. Translation. The self-realized Brahmana Jatbharat said, among the various material combinations and permutations, there are various forms and earthly transformations. For some reason, these move on the surface of the earth and are called palanquin carriers. Those material transformations which do not move are gross material objects like stones. In any case, the material body is made of earth and stone in the form of feet, ankles, calves, knees, thighs, torso, throat and head. Upon the shoulders is the wooden palanquin, and within the palanquin is the so-called king of Sovira. The body of the king is simply another transformation of earth, but within that body your lordship is situated and falsely thinking that you are the king of the state of Sovira. Little cutting. Purport. After analyzing the material bodies of the palanquin carrier and the palanquin passenger, Jadbharat concludes that the real living force is the living entity. The living entity is the offshoot or offspring of Lord Vishnu. Therefore, within this material world, among moving and non-moving things, the real principle is Lord Vishnu. Due to his presence, everything is working and there are actions and reactions. One who understands Lord Vishnu as the original cause of everything is to be understood, to be perfectly situated in knowledge. Although he was falsely proud of being a king, King Rahugana was not really situated in knowledge. Therefore, he was rebuking the palanquin carriers, including the self-realized Brahmana, Jadbharat. This is the first accusation Jadbharat made against the king, who was daring to talk to a learned Brahmana from the flimsy ground of ignorance, identifying everything but matter. King Rahugana argued that the living entity is within the body, that when the body is fatigued, the living entity must therefore be suffering. It is clearly explained in the following verses, but that the living entity does not suffer due to the body's fatigue. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti gives an example of a child heavily decorated with ornaments. Although the child's body is very delicate, he does not feel fatigue, nor do the parents think that his ornaments should be taken away. The living entity has nothing to do with bodily pains and pleasure. These are simple mental concoctions. An intelligent man will find the original cause of everything. Material combinations and permutations may be a matter of fact in worldly dealings, but actually the living force, the soul, has nothing to do with them. Those who are materially upset take care of the body and manufacture Daridra Narayan, poor Narayan. However, it is not a fact that the soul or super soul becomes poor simply because the body is poor. These are the statements of ignorant people. The soul and super soul are always apart from bodily pleasure and pain. Om Agyanati Manandasya Agyanandana Salakya Sakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Sigurave Namaha Mukam Karoti Vachanam Pangam Langeti Ganim Yat Kripatamam Vande Sigurun Dinatarinam Shri Chaitanya Miswaram Paramananda Madhavam Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare So since I'm speaking for a few days, I thought I should develop some sort of theme in the lecture, and the theme that I had in mind is Srimad Bhagavatam. And yesterday I spoke about how Srimad Bhagavatam is the center of all our understanding and philosophy, and that basically all knowledge either leads up to Srimad Bhagavatam or expands on Srimad Bhagavatam, or we concluded on Chaitanya Charitamrita that because of the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Chaitanya Charitamrita gives us entrance into Srimad Bhagavatam. Because Srimad Bhagavatam is described as Amalam Puranam, or the spotless Purana, which means it is purely from the transcendental plane. So everything within Srimad Bhagavatam is basically revealing the spiritual world in its entirety, not fragments, not partial, complete. As Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu commented in, as mentioned in Chaitanya Bhagavat, that Srimad Bhagavatam in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end is only dealing with pure devotional service and nothing else. Well, here the king, Maharaj Rahugana, is a king within Vedic culture, and therefore the king had certainly knowledge. It wasn't that he was completely ignorant, and yet he had a very superficial relationship with that knowledge. And therefore, although externally he was aware of all these windows are close. Otherwise, write me off tomorrow. Sorry. So the king had a very superficial relationship with transcendental knowledge. Some sort of general theoretical understanding. And obviously the king had some sort of social sense of etiquette. When there was a clearly recognizable brahmana in some sort of formal setting, then the king might have also formally offered respect, right? So that he was, in a way, adhering to Vedic culture. I'm drawing or setting out this example of the king's superficial relationship with knowledge. I'd like to draw a parallel with our own situation, where possibly the same weakness may creep in, where we also have a very superficial relationship with the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, and just like the king, offer our respect to very obvious persons. If someone walks around with a huge danda, all right, you know, then we offer obeisances. But as they sometimes say, we bow to those above and we kick downwards, right? Whereas if we look at the verse Trinadapi Suniche Na, which is saying, okay, as we all know, more humble than a blade of grass, more tolerant than a tree, and so on. At the very conclusion of the verse, the point is stressed, one should offer respect to all others. It doesn't say to all other Vaishnavas. Right? And that's very interesting, right? Because yes, Vanchakalpa to Rubia, and then, you know, the rest of the world, these are, after all, fallen people. But if we have a general respectful attitude towards everyone, seeing that towards every living being, then we can give everyone due space, and within it due respect. It doesn't mean that we naively accepting as positive everything a conditioned soul is presenting. Sometimes we see in our movement a philosophy developing that, well, you know, the long ago the devotees would only appreciate other devotees and the rest of the world were meat-eating karmi demons, right? So fortunately, we have evolved from that platform, and now actually we are having a lot of appreciation for a lot of the things that are going on out there. That's very good. Of course, in another sense, there are meat-eating karmi demons. What can we say? They also, it's not that we want to label the whole world like that, but there certainly are such people also in the world, right? They do eat meat. They are only interested in sense gratification, and they are outright demons. We can be respectful and yet not gullible, right? And that is very interesting. We can respect everyone and try to find the good in a person without buying into everything the person is believing or writing or saying and so on. I remember Ravindra Sarup once making this analogy, which I remembered. He said, just as we are taking boga, we have to take the boga, we have to make it suitable for offering to Krishna. We have to cut off some parts and clean it and this and that and then prepare it properly and then we can offer. So he says, whatever we take from the material world, or material sources, is like boga. It has to be purified, some parts have to be cut out, and then, all right, the useful part, properly prepared, we can offer it to Krishna. And I thought that really shedded some light on our relationship with the world. Nonetheless, going back to the superficial attitude of Maharaj Rahugana, who could not, because he was not respectfully inclined towards everyone, and Jat Bharat was not openly manifesting all the attributes of a Brahmana. He was not necessarily, we know Jat Bharat was an avaduta who was not really keeping his body clean and who was not really dressing very nicely in a typical Brahminical fashion, although he was from a Brahminical background, he didn't behave like a Brahmana. For example, he would wash his hands at the wrong time. Yeah. His father tried to teach him like that, you know, like the hands should be washed after one has touched something impure, and he would just mix it up. He would wash them just at the wrong time and just couldn't learn how to properly wash his hands. In this way, but it was a strategy because Jat Bharat was remembering previous lives and quite frustrating, remembering how he was a king, how he had engaged in self-realization, become attached to a deer, how as a result he had become a deer. So after that, and even remembering these two lives, Jat Bharat was very careful this time, extremely careful, and therefore he remained aloof from the world. That was his approach. Simply, let me not get involved in worldly affairs, and therefore I'll be a person who is socially dysfunctional. And that was what he chose to be as his modus operandi. But we see that within Jat Bharat was deeply knowledgeable, deeply realized, and his so-called dysfunctional attitude was simply an external facade, and within he was very deep, not only in scriptural knowledge but in applied scriptural knowledge. Jat Bharat, unlike the king, had a very deep transcendental vision. Not only did he take the philosophy that we are aham brahmasmi, that we are the eternal spirit soul and not this material body, but he really applied it, right, in such a detailed and intricate way. Right? And the way he's describing here how there are combinations of earth and they transform into various shapes or react chemical reactions, materials, and so on, and he just points out that there are these palanquin carriers, because the king tried to force him to become a palanquin carrier. Right? Basically, the king needed another palanquin carrier. And they just picked somebody up from the road and forced him to carry the palanquin. And that happened to be Jat Bharat. And then Jat Bharat wasn't so good at it, because he wasn't good at anything material. And one reason why he wasn't good at it, because there were ends on the path, and he was trying to avoid stepping on these ends. So he was like making funny movements, and the king was rocking in the palanquin, and for this reason became very upset with Jat Bharat. But now Jat Bharat is just preaching applied philosophy, deeply realized philosophy. And this is actually the purpose of scripture. It is said, Shastra Shakshus, one must look at the world through the scriptures. One must see everywhere Srimad Bhagavatam, everywhere. Wherever one looks, one must not just read Srimad Bhagavatam, one must see it. And one must see the entire world in the perspective of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And that is what we're seeing here. Jat Bharat is seeing the world in the perspective of the Bhagavat. So that is, it is not just that we are reading Srimad Bhagavatam as our daily companion, as I established yesterday, and that Bhagavatam is always at any time with us. No. Our vision becomes Bhagavat. We just see the entire world through the Bhagavatam, and we see that reality. And we can see many examples in Srila Prabhupada. They didn't go to the moon. I mean, to you, that may not mean much, but to those who have gray hairs, maybe it means more, because, you know, we were sitting in front of the TV, and we saw... Right, we saw the whole thing, and the space shuttle was just going through outer space, and the different nations, you know, there was the Cold War at that time, but and the Iron Curtain, but you know, this was the one thing where the whole world cooperated. Yes, and ground control was passing from one nation to another. And everyone felt, and it was glorified on TV how the world was becoming united and how wonderful it was. And then, you know, we saw them jumping on the moon. I was there, I saw it with my own eyes, and then Prabhupada said it didn't happen. I mean, it was to that effect, you can see. So it was not as casual as, you know, it may sound here and now. It had great impact to all of us. Right? It was deep. Yes, Prabhupada in this way put his faith completely in Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam was the reality. And there are many other examples that Prabhupada gave. I mean, I like it, and from time to time use the example that Prabhupada described paintings about Krishna as windows to the spiritual world. Taking that analogy then a step further, then looking at the windows, then those are the paintings, logically speaking. Then those are the paintings, and that's really like the picture out there. That's not real. But those paintings, that's real. And Prabhupada saw in this way, through Srimad Bhagavatam, and saw the spiritual reality as reality. And in this way, one can rise above the dictates of the body. The body, vachavegam, manasagrovavegam, jivavegam, udrapastavegam, etanvegam, yuvishetadira, sarvam apam pityam. The body has the pushings of the senses, the pushings of the mind, tongue, belly, genitals, and so on, anger. These kind of pushings are upon all of us. Sometimes they are speaking about hunger, thirst, lamentation, infirmity, old age, and death as the Sat Urmi. Six waves that sort of sweep us along, or other times they're called six whips that sort of whip us along on the path. So very much we are being pushed in life by the pushings of the body. And that we have to gradually let go of, really, not take so serious, not like... like, for example, the question then can be raised, yes, but what do you do? What do you do? What do you do when you become suddenly attacked by sex desire, what do you do? Well, the first option is nothing. That's probably the best option, yeah? Really. I mean, looking at it, that's the most intelligent option we can suggest. Do nothing. Right? If that's absolutely impossible, then do something, but don't do something that harms spiritual progress. Because otherwise you are atmaha, a killer of the soul. Yeah? That's spiritual suicide. And that, of course, we can't allow. Yeah? That's not allowed. That is foolishness. So yes, one has to... the reason why we are forgetful, we are forgetful of transcendental knowledge. Srimad Bhagavatam is helping us to open the darkened eyes, to develop this vision. And then if we keep on remembering the vision, then whenever the pushings arise, or to say it in more contemporary language, when the impulses appear, then we have to preach to ourselves. Right? Preaching is a big topic in Prabhupada's books. Right? It's all about preaching. But preaching has to first of all be done to one's own mind. That's very important. Constantly, the mind is coming up with undesirable elements, and then we have to present the mind. Wait a minute, you know. You want this, I know. You want it really bad, I know. And you don't care about the consequences, I know. But Srimad Bhagavatam is describing something else. See, that sort of should kick in. I had developed a theme how different people are influenced by Srimad Bhagavatam some years ago in a metaphorical way. One example is Kamsa. Kamsa, who is, it is described that once Kamsa was seated on his throne, and at that time, Kamsa was in great fear, in great anxiety. He's thinking, you know, Krishna, Krishna, any moment he can come and kill. You know, this prophecy can come true. Any moment, I cannot be off guard for a moment, right? Just one little moment of inattentiveness, he can strike. So Kamsa was totally alert, and always thinking. And then he's thinking, what can he do to me? What can this Krishna do to me anyway? I have very powerful allies, like Casey. Krishna, what can he do? Just then, some messengers came into the court of the king and said, your majesty, a tragedy, a tragedy. What is it? What is it? Your majesty. Casey, no, 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 no. Your majesty, Casey is dead. No, he is so powerful. It's inconceivable. Even Casey, no, now what to do? What to do? He's thinking, oh my God, what can I do? He's just undefeatable. And he's thinking, maybe I should just surrender. Maybe I should just surrender to him. You know, he's thinking, no, how can I do that? What would people say if I, Kamsa, surrender to him? No, that I could not do. Then maybe I should just go to Vrindavan and torture the residents of Vrindavan. But how can I do that when I'm too afraid to leave the palace? It's a passage from the Nectar of Devotion. And I like it very much because it shows Kamsa's moment of doubt. Right? It shows how Krishna, his presence is just working like a thunderbolt on the heart of the demon, and it cracks it cracks the heart, the very heart layer that is there around the demoniac heart, and creates like a crack, at least a temporary crack in Kamsa's heart, before a moment even he thought, maybe I should surrender. So in this way we can see how Srimad Bhagavatam can crack the hearts of the demons and can penetrate even there, because Bhagavatam is non-different from Krishna. It is the literary incarnation of Krishna. It is identified in that way. So in this way, Bhagavatam acts like a thunderbolt. Then I thought, and for those who are covered by ignorance, Bhagavatam Puranako Dinuditaha, it is gradually working like light. It is lighting, it brings light. It brings us insight, light and knowledge. And then one comes to the point where one begins to see that this transcendental knowledge, it is true. So through the light of Bhagavatam, one can begin to see, yes, this is the truth. Then the next stage is where one can begin to relate to Bhagavatam like a mirror. And one takes all these narratives here about personalities like Jat Bharat and Maharaj Rahugan. And we can, of course, look at this narration and say, look at this Maharaj Rahugan, a typical prototype of a shallow, materialistic person, falsely proud, and see, oh see, how the fellow is carried away. Fortunately, Jat Bharat's doing a great job. Applause, applause. The devotees win again. Yes, yes, yes. And like this, we can read it for our entertainment, you know, like as if it is a good football match and Jat Bharat scored a beautiful goal and all the devotees go, goal, yeah, he did well, you know. Cut him down well. And we walk away from it and say, this is a lovely story. Lovely. Really lovely. But that's a little too cheap, right? We have to take it a little bit further and become introspective and apply it to ourselves. How much of Rahuguna is living in us? That is Bhagavatam. So therefore, the mirror approach, where the devotee starts to look at Srimad Bhagavatam and in Srimad Bhagavatam finds himself. Introspection through the scriptures, I sometimes call it. So that is another level. When one becomes more serious in this way and more introspective and one becomes ready to accept one's own anarthas, and that there may be even some that we haven't acknowledged yet, then one comes open to search through Srimad Bhagavatam and to deeply contemplate on Srimad Bhagavatam. And we go to these stories of Srimad Bhagavatam, and they are not all sweet stories, right? Bhagavatam is not a collection of many sweet stories about Krishna. Bhagavatam many times gets heavy, confrontational, right? Like in this verse, it's heavy, it's strong, it's confrontational. But it's confronting us, and it's confronting us with our own anarthas that we don't even want to admit to ourselves. But it forces us. Therefore, as soon as we think that we can go away from Srimad Bhagavatam, then we are losing ourselves in the woods. And maybe we think, let's go to the forest of Vrindavan. Yes. But there also we can get lost. Without Bhagavatam, we will get lost there also. Yes. And we will not meet Krishna face to face, because it is through Bhagavatam that will meet Krishna face to face. So one who gets very serious like that, to live a life by Bhagavatam, then starts to more and more accept all the directions of Bhagavatam, the directives of Bhagavatam in his life, and in this way applies Bhagavatam like the reins, right? The reins in his life, the reins by which we are governing a horse, yeah,
pulling the reins.
And then a whole life becomes steered by Bhagavatam, and it becomes like the measurement of what we should do, what we should not do, how we arrange our life. And we start to arrange our life around Srimad Bhagavatam. And in this way, the purification takes place. See, there is mercy within the Srimad Bhagavatam. It is Krishna manifests himself in the Bhagavatam, his instructions are there. There's mercy. Then when we look at the topic of mercy, then there are two aspects to mercy that we can look at. One is mercy on a mystic level. You know, you don't know exactly how it works, but you know that it works, or you believe it works. We take darshan of the deity, and we know we're getting mercy. Exactly what transpires, you can't see, but it happens. You take some prasadam, and something happens. We believe that something happens, but what it is exactly, we can't see. And then there's very tangible, practical aspect of mercy in the form of instructions, something we can clearly say, if you follow this, then that mercy will develop and manifest. So by following the Srimad Bhagavatam, this practical, tangible aspect of Bhagavatam, of the instructions, that mercy will become part of our life. And then we become more sensitive also. And then even the mystic aspect of Krishna's mercy becomes more and more a reality to us. And in this way, the devotee begins to relish Srimad Bhagavatam. After the rains, we come to the stage where we relish Srimad Bhagavatam. Every word of it. It is at that stage we read Srimad Bhagavatam, beginning with Ruchi, and then our attachment to Krishna is very deep, and we're so happy that we can do any devotional service. And everything is just a great source of enthusiasm. And then you see like an example, like for example in Vrindavan we had this devotee named Vibhu Chaitanya. And Vibhu Chaitanya was an elderly Bengali gentleman who had joined the Krishna Balaram Mandir from practically the opening of the temple. He came there and he practically from the beginning became the deity cook and he cooked everything. I mean, the milk, sweets, all the offerings, everything, right? Until very advanced old age, he cooked like that. And, at one point, when I was temple president, he became too old, and his legs started to swell up so bad, and he just couldn't stand anymore. So then I had to convince him that he just couldn't do it anymore, and that he should just take another service and start giving out Charnamrita. Well, it took him 3 days in his room. He was sick. He didn't come out of his room, and he was grumbling for 3 days. And then he accepted it. And then he just sat there next to the deities giving out Charnamrita. And he made a whole thing of that. You know, he had tulsi leaves in boxes ready for devotees. For sannyasis or other senior devotees, he had special cups, you know, like and all these little special cups. It became a huge thing, you know, like completely, like, made a whole thing. So, totally absorbed. Right? And in the end, he was not well at all. He became kind of incapacitated. So then he just couldn't even get out of his room anymore. But in his room, we had on the wall pictures of the deities, and he had a loudspeaker that connected him to the temple so that he could always hear everything of the temple. So meditation unbroken, you know, unbroken. And Vibhu Chaitanya, he never left the grounds. He never went outside the wall. of the Krishna Balaram temple in all those years, yes, from 1975 till he left this world, he never ever went outside the gate. So what for? You know, I mean, he had no reason, right? Because there was no service there. His service was simply inside. So he didn't do anything that wasn't devotional service. Never thought, should I go for a walk? He never went to the Goshala. Now his samadhi is at the Goshala. He's never been there during his life. Never. Right? Because he never went outside of the walls. Never, ever. Completely absorbed. So then you can see, you know, a little bit of what it means to have deep attachment. Yeah? Deep attachment. So in this way, gradually, as one is using the reins of Bhagavatam, one comes to the place where one start to find ponds of nectar, amazing bodies, water bodies, beautiful ghats, and very transcendental. Until finally one comes to the ocean of Prem, the Prema Sagar, or Premamritambo, where the six Goswamis were residing, it is said, always emerged in this ocean of transcendental ecstasy. So in this way, there is no stage of advancement where one abandons Srimad Bhagavatam and say, now I've graduated, you know, to something higher, you know. No. One always, at all stages, stays with Bhagavatam. It's just one's, at all stages, one continues to serve the deity. At all stages, one just continues, but one's consciousness changes in the process, so the relationship changes. And if we faithfully serve the deity, the Prabhupada said, one day the deity will talk to you. Well, why not? Can be. And Prabhupada also said that at the end of life, the deity will come. If a pujari faithfully serves the deity's whole life, at the end of life, the deity will come personally to take you back to Godhead. Not bad. Not bad at all. So, yes, so in this way, externally, one reads Srimad Bhagavatam in early stages of Krishna consciousness, and one reads Srimad Bhagavatam in the most advanced stages of Krishna consciousness. And in this way, as Sanatan Goswami yesterday said, Bhagavatam is our constant companion. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Yes, yes, in Samadhi, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, there's a Samadhi there on the Goshala land, yeah, yeah. Samadhis? You want your samadhi in Radhadesh? Just tell us. in the middle of Rupa's room. Yeah. Bajakuj. No, but somewhere in the... Yeah, why not? If Ridai allows it, but, he has to bless it. Otherwise, no way. Any questions? I think that someone who becomes like that is at an early stage has an exaggerated understanding of his own importance from day one. He's like thinking, my views, my opinions, my realizations, my experience. And such a person may relate to Prabhupada and as like a resource, you know, like Prabhupada gives us all this knowledge, very nice. But he doesn't develop this the mood of a deep relationship and understanding that at every moment we depend on Prabhupada. And that spiritual advancement doesn't mean to become more independent from Prabhupada, but that it means to become more dependent, more and more dependent. It becomes fine-tuned. Right? At first, you know, we sort of like, oh, well, how many regulator principles am I supposed to follow? And then, okay, at one point, I think it's four, and then it's four, and then, okay, and then there's a few more things to do. So gradually, it becomes more and more refined. And in this way, one realizes more and more that in all these areas, Prabhupada was there. You know, when we reach somewhere, there's an offering, a Vyasa Puja offering from Bhari Narayan Prabhu, who writes nice offerings. He always has nice stories. So he has this story how he was thinking for the vacation this year. I want to go somewhere and I want to preach in like new territory. So he sat down with the world map and had a look at it. And it looks like, you know, the globe on his desk and then, New Guinea. You know, well, okay, you know, there are cannibals on New Guinea. So it's sort of a field, you know. So, okay, he flew to New Guinea, came, arrived there, and when he finally, after a long trip from America all the way to New Guinea, came to the hotel that he had sort of booked, you know, then the receptionist behind the desk was reading Prabhupada's book. And he realized, Prabhupada, you're already there, you know, before I arrived. So it's like that every time in spiritual life, wherever we get, at any stage in our spiritual life, we have to acknowledge that Prabhupada was already there long, long ago, and that Prabhupada understood that stage completely. So therefore, at any stage, we must take shelter of Prabhupada. So such kind of people have not taken shelter of Prabhupada, they've taken advantage of the knowledge that Prabhupada gave for their own purposes. And now they feel, my power has increased so much, therefore now I am eligible. That is the disease. Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah. Also inside, by the way. Everywhere demons, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. By a demon? Oh my God. I always thought I was a devotee. You know? Yeah. 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 Well, like your T-shirt says, you know, today only free hugs, cause you're special, right? So that principle is like, even if someone is a demon, you know, there are demons, obviously. Stalin, for example, was a bit of a demon. He killed a lot of people, right? I mean, you know, there are demons out there, without a doubt. And maybe there are little Stalins also, and so on. So, what can we say? There are demons everywhere in the universe. But how do you deal with them? See, even Kamsa, who was a demon, recognized, certified. Kamsa was a certified demon. Yeah, he had the official demon mark. Yeah, I mean, just as when you want to buy a woolen sweater, you want to make sure the wool mark is in there. Well, if you look for a demon, Kamsa had the official demon mark, right? Certified in scripture. But even Kamsa, like I described, had his moment of where he was, for a moment, he was devotionally inclined. And therefore, within every demon, there is a devotee. And Prabhupada said, and the purpose of this movement is to turn crows into swans. That is our business. There you go. What's on your back? Om Bhur Bhuvah. Okay, you got the Gayatri mantra on the back. Okay. Well, thank you. Yes. Yeah, okay, but was his approach selfish? Because he was acting externally as a madman and he could have helped so many other people. But before one helps others, one has to help himself. That's also there, you know. So, of course, we're looking at Jat Bharat from the perspective of the Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya, which is very much focused on helping others. But we sometimes forget that point, that we first have to help ourselves. And Jat Bharat, of course, having remembrance of a big failure and of the heavy reactions thereof, of becoming an animal, was very careful by the arrangement of the Lord. It was the grace of the Lord upon him, because as Maharaj Bharat, he had obviously pleased the Lord very much. And so the Lord gave him this remembrance. And well, if you remember such a fall down, anybody would be careful, after that. Whoa. So that was very much inspired by the Supreme Lord. Of course, this meeting with Maharaj Rahugana was also orchestrated by the Supreme Lord to bring out Jat Bharat. And Jat Bharat, sometimes, you know, when you think about preaching, right, you can, of course, you know, get a cape, right, and just, you know, with flapping cape, run around the door, right, and try to, you know, reach as many people as you can and run and run and run. Or you could, for a long time, go really in depth and then come out in a big burst. Prabhupada, a lifetime in preparation, we are, at least Satsarupa Maharaj, you know, coined that phrase about Prabhupada's earlier life, and I think he captured a principle that he recognized in Prabhupada. He waited. So Jat Bharat also. It all built up in him, matured in him, and then bang, you know, it comes out with Maharaj Rahugana in powerful slokas that are here today, that didn't just cut the false ego of Maharaj Rahugana, but also cut ours very effectively. Yeah.
Just like Prigit Marsh, he gave up his duty of protecting the citizens. He sits down for 7 days, but his protection is extended to us.
Yeah. And just as the whole thing with Pariksit Maharaj was going on by divine arrangement, because the king was a devotee, he was very humble, very nice, and suddenly he's sort of mistreating this sage because he gets this incredible thirst that he has never ever had in his life. He's walking in the forest, dying of thirst, and becoming so agitated that he doesn't treat a sage completely nicely, right? You know, which he would have never done. And it's all divinely steered. So these personalities are controlled by the Supreme Lord. Yeah, he would take your hand, that's true. Only interested in devotional service. I mean, when I was a new devotee, I was cutting vegetables for him and cleaning some things. I was his kitchen helper for a while. And he was very precise and very serious about that. Later I was, as a new bhakta, I was washing the deity plates, and he would inspect them that they were clean. He was making sure that it was really done well. And later, when I became his temple president, then he started to he was very humble. And then he would accept my authority. You know, then he would ask me whatever I said he would do. Okay, this change of service took 3 days. That was the toughest part. But, that's the way to go back to Godhead. And he would always give Mahaprasad, of course. Okay. Read I Chaitanya Prabhu. The last sentence of the Bhagavad Gita says the soul and super soul are always part of the body of the first. Yeah. But without soul, you wouldn't be able to go to the presence of the soul, you wouldn't be able to experience. Yeah. I read in an essay of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, an explanation about the situation of the soul when the soul becomes embodied, which to me was a very valuable explanation. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta explains that when the soul enters into the body, the soul enters into a dormant state, and the original functions of the soul, which are thinking, feeling, and willing, are then being borrowed by the mind. Can you just stop blocking read eye? Yeah. Because we're just having eye contact, and then you put your head in the middle, which is very nice. Nice head, but still, if you wouldn't mind. So he says like that the thinking, feeling, and willing are now borrowed by the mind. So although the soul lends the energy to the whole experience, the soul itself is not actively involved in the material experience. It's the mind that's going through the whole thing. And so if we go back to thinking, feeling, and willing on the level of the soul by devotional service, that thinking, feeling, and willing is awakened. Now I'm speaking theoretically. Then one is supposed to be able to rise above the pleasures and pain of the body. I, haven't managed that part yet. Yeah. Poor soul. Yes, correct. Yeah, poor soul. Yes, yeah. Yeah, in a way, Prabhupada also said that we never fall down, right? We are still in the spiritual world. The jiva doesn't fall from the spiritual world because we're still there. It's just we're covered, and when it becomes uncovered, then everything is back. You know? Still, still we're experiencing intense suffering in the material world. And I think that this kind of philosophy that the soul and super soul are always apart from bodily pleasure and pain is nice in the ultimate sense to understand, but I don't think that it's something that has so much practical application right now. I mean, we are, like I was saying yesterday, when the leading sannyasi preached, you know, to us who are like out on Sankirtan, that the soul is never tired. You know, we are never tired because the soul is never tired. I was like, I couldn't. it took away my enthusiasm, you know, actually, because it seemed like, well, you know, it's beyond my capacity. If this is what I have to live up to, I may as well forget it. You know, it's just, I can see that this is too high. So we should not take it in that way, right? That we have to now never, we have to now, any identification with bodily pleasure or pain is illusion, it's not real. It is illusion, it is not real in the ultimate sense. But as it is, we are all covered by the material energy, and we just simply, from that condition, do as much devotional service as we can. And then even if in this life we never come to this stage where we completely rise above pleasure and pain, as long as we remain faithful, then we have all the chance of the mercy of Krishna. Just like Apuryamanam Achala Pratistam, the rivers are flowing into the ocean, the ocean is so full. Prabhupada says in the purport to Bhagavad Gita 270, the desires are present, but one doesn't act upon it. Yeah? So that is sufficient. It is sufficient if one is on that level. Because this is very high level, very, very high level. To realize. But Sukadev Goswami is given as an example who was on that level, yeah, completely nirapeksha, completely unaffected by the material energy. Yeah. That's not easy. We'll stop now. Thank you so much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Yeah. Willkommen.